It is my distinct honor and pleasure to introduce someone to you who needs no introduction, someone who's really done very important work that's influenced all of us in this room in a lot of important ways, someone who I think we all have a lot of admiration for. Leif Nelson received his PhD from Princeton University and went to NYU and is now a chair and professor of marketing at the University of California, Berkeley. In addition, of course, it's really a pleasure to be able to introduce my former undergraduate mentor who got me into the field, whose accomplishments speak for themselves. I feel silly listing all the honors and everything else here, except to say that last night we learned from Danny that Paul Slovic is as close to perfect in my book. Danny's not too far off that mark. And those of us who have been lucky enough to work with him have not only learned a great deal about research and how to do it right, but also I think a lot about research values and how to conduct yourself and how to treat people and how to act professionally. And the lessons that I learned during my undergraduate time with Danny doing my honors thesis have stuck with me since then. The question I guess that is you want to ask is what can I tell you about Danny that you don't already know? One thing I suppose that came out talking with a couple of friends who know Danny well is that he really lives his research in a lot of ways. The source material comes from reveling in his own, I think, irrationality sometimes. And a couple of anecdotes stand out. Of course, David Shigati reminded me of that famous paper that he wrote with Danny in, what was it, 1998, on whether Californians are really happier, which David seems to think was really more about Danny's disagreements with his wife, Ann Treisman, about whether they should go back to California from Princeton or not. Danny had to win that argument with data to stay at Princeton, I guess. But the other anecdote that was shared with me came from Dick Thaler, who reminded me that Danny has a sweet tooth. And I do remember going to the vending machine in Berkeley as an undergraduate for candy sometimes with him. But apparently he used a heuristic in his own life that when he would go to dinner with people, they had an N plus one heuristic, that the number of people plus one is the number of desserts that you should order. And then apparently he learned a little bit later on that he had diabetes, so he changed it to an N minus one heuristic after that. In any case, let me not take away any time from what I'm sure will be a very stimulating, fun interview for us all, so please give a warm welcome to Leif Nelson and Danny Cohn.
I'm curious what you're most proud of, and I guess the one thing I will do is I'll license you to list something that's not a paper or a prize, but maybe an idea or a contribution or a student or something like that, and how you think about it.
It doesn't have to be a paper. The thing that I'm proudest of looking at my career are the friends I have. It was Lucy Foos, Thaler, David Shigati, many, many others. That's what I'm really proud of. I've collaborated as a student. I've enjoyed doing that. I've been rewarded for doing it. That's what comes to mind.
I would say you are part of the collaborative duo that is by far the most well-regarded in this. And so I just have a couple of questions about Amos Diversity, and again, you'll pardon me that I'm looking for sort of personal insight. So that is, we have a room full of people who have read plausibly all of your papers and all of his, or at least deeply embraced them, but not very many of us had a chance to know Amos. And so here again, what I'm looking for would be a narrative of something about him that maybe we don't know. Him as a person, or him as a thinker, or him as a researcher.
Well, you know, one could talk about Amos for a very long time. He died more than 19 years ago. It's going to be 20 years next June. But he's still remembered, actually, in the memories of people you hear. I think he's more alive than most other dead people are. there's really something. And being alive was very much, that was the sense. And I actually remember you talking of sad things. You reminded me of something that Paul Slovic said about Amos at his funeral. And he said it's not representative for Amos not to be a man. He was life itself.
Yeah. The view of any collaboration, particularly with Amos, is, as you say, feels warm and engaged. And so the image that we necessarily have is of two men that agree on everything. Because by the time you get to a paper, it's what you agree on that gets printed. I'm curious if there were notable disagreements, either intellectual or personal or whatever, that like sort of held stay with you over time.
Well, it's true that Amos and I, for a long time, so long as when we were working together, we had to agree on every word. We usually wrote together and we discussed everything. It took us a year, I think almost a year, to write the 1974 paper. We were working together maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, every working day. But it was such a pleasure, actually, to do that. It's easy to be a perfectionist, you know, when you're not bored, and we were never bored.
Wow. That sounds pretty good. I like the idea of the lack of boredom leading to a sense of perfection. Were there, so that's in the sense of writing and thinking. Was there, I think when you talk about any different person in the field and we say we don't all agree on what we believe about people or about theories, were there things where you didn't resolve?
Well, we had very different, we were quite different actually in some ways, sufficiently overlapping so that we found it easy to understand each other, but sufficiently different so that we kept surprising each other. And together we covered more ground than I think either one of us covered alone. So there was sort of implicit division of labor, although between the two of us, that I was the more intuitive, vague type, and he was the clear one. He knew where we were going. He knew where the field was. He had a much better perspective on everything. And I was throwing ideas. And the joy of the collaboration for me was in large part that he would understand me more clearly than I understood myself. And I think to some extent there was something symmetric that I knew what he was trying to do. And we knew each other's mind very well, but our minds still were quite different. Now, in terms of the substantive disagreement, there was one, which actually I think it's turned out to be quite consequential. And that was about anchoring. When we wrote the 1974 paper, we felt we had those nice results on anchoring. We were not going not to include them. But on the other hand, anchoring really is not a heuristic in the same way that representativeness and availability. There is no way that you can create a sort of coherent concept of anchoring. So we argued a lot about what anchoring is, and we actually never agreed. It turned out that we had two different views of anchoring. He thought of it as adjustment. I thought of it basically as suggestion or priming. Turned out later we're both right. That is, there are two forms of anchoring. They're different, and they're there. But we disagreed very much about that. And we had a hard time deciding what to do with anchoring in that paper. And I think, in some way, the very blurry definition of heuristics that we had to offer in order to include anchoring in that paper translated into an even bigger focus on biases than we had sort of intended. So the paper was called Heuristics and Biases, but what people retained from it was biases and So the individual heuristics, the idea of the heuristic process, wasn't there. We couldn't manage to develop it.
It's fascinating. And in describing all of that, of course, it resonates with, you know, I've read all this, oh, that's true, anger doesn't fit as well. I'm curious, the part that, for all of the things that we all do, right here, a general question, is there something that you've done, either alone or with Amos, that you feel like either you didn't publish or never got the attention to deserve, the hidden gem of something that you've worked on?
No, I mean, my memory isn't good enough. I mean, it's not the kind of thing. There are many things that we didn't publish. But, you know, one thing that happens when you write a book, as I did when you're already quite old, is that by the time you finish the book, you've forgotten absolutely everything that's not in it. So everything I know is in that book and nothing else. It's a hard question for me.
A well-earned hard answer. It's nice to be in a position where so much of it is there. I want to ask a question about a sort of a change in the field that strikes me, and I think that you would have a good perspective on. So, when I got involved in the field, a common lament in sort of big talks would be how psychology or judgment decision making doesn't have enough influence in policy. Usually followed by a comment that was like, oh, the policymakers just listen to the economists. We don't have a seat at the table. And I would say, we definitely have a seat at the table now, much more than in the past, because of your work and Dick with the through Nudge and the different Nudge units that are proliferating in various nations around the world. How do you see that? Do you see that as a uniformly positive outcome? Do you see other consequences of that change?
Well, okay. I think it's certainly... it's a wonderful development. It's sort of funny because it's mostly social psychology and it's called behavior economics. And that's because, you know, Dick Thaler, who is an economist, started this with Cass Sunstein. I think it's a very good development. And there is a nice touch to it in that it's not, you know, this is really good psychology. There is no overarching theory. It's not big. It's interventions that cost essentially nothing and that achieve small but reliable effects. And it sort of represents my understanding where psychology in this particular field is at the moment. I think it's a great problem. And it's just starting, really, but it's moving very rapidly.
I think from that perspective, I'm guessing that, again, in part because of the popularity of your work and Dick's and others, this feels like sort of a golden age for judgment decision making. It is more people are likely to listen to what we have to say. And again, I attribute some part of that not only to your publicly winning the Nobel Prize, which is amazing for you mostly, but also for us because we get to pretend that we're associated with it. But also your book, in that it brought many more people who wouldn't know how to access it. And here I'm going to ask this general question, because I know, having watched a number of your interviews, preparing for this, watched a number of your interviews and reading your interviews, one of the main things that you will bring up is some form of how much you dislike writing it. And I'm curious about your perspective of, either from the perspective of advice, like someone else who might write a book, or your insights from having done it, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, don't be neurotic is my best advice. I mean, if you could help it. Writing a book like that is a major challenge because I was trying to write for the public, for the intelligent public, educated public, and at the same time without losing the respect of my colleagues. And I always felt that I was missing out on at least one of them, and frequently on both. So it was a very big process. It turned out the book had much more impact than I had anticipated, which was generally true. All the book that Amos and I did, we were surprised by the response to it. I was very surprised by the response to the book. There was something ironic about why the book had that impact. And it had an impact because of an idea. That is, to one extent hackneyed and to the other controversial. It's the idea of two systems, which wasn't my idea. But this is what people really took out, take out of the book. Many of them, you know, those who reach page 100, that's not a very few go beyond that, and not many get to there. But they get that idea of two processes, which, you know, is not mine. It's common in the field. It's debated whether, you know, it's a good way of describing the way the mind works. And but it has had a great deal more impact than I expected, because it turns out people recognize something in that those there are two ways they think, and that idea it has helped them organize many things. How it connects to the rest of the work we did, it's true, it creates, I think, a willingness to look at, you know, products of the mind that are not completely reasonable or not completely rational. And in that sense, it fits in general. And you're right. Getting the Nobel was a very good thing for me. but it was a good thing for the field. I mean, there's no question. We got collectively more respect because of that, because we're very good people. It's absurd, you know, the weight that the Nobel has, because it is not the most selected of prizes. I mean, you know, in terms of my personal prizes, it's not the one that I'm the proudest of. I'm much prouder of, you know, having had the career award from the American Psychological Association. It's more meaningful, it's actually less common, and yet the Nobel had that odd aura that, you know, when you get this, something special is attached to you. That makes no sense whatsoever, which is very nice.
You're right, I was going to say that the Nobel is totally not selective. It's interesting, across the dialogues, those two things, looking at the influence of the book, and I described this, it's a notion of what people resonate with is a description of how the human mind works. And I put that in sort of contrast to this other version of influence, which I think of the policy side that is having a seat at the table. And this brings up, this is kind of a conceptual concern or consideration of mine, that when we hire a new faculty member or evaluate a researcher, we say, I want that person to do high impact research. And I would have said, the field generally, what they mean by that, ends up looking like something like, oh, I want to see field experiments or analysis of field data. But I would have said, your work, which I think we can argue is pretty high impact, it's not based on that. It's based on conceptual lawyers and engineers or a hypothetical Linda and her occupational choices. How do you see the trade-off in terms, basically, or even this? Do you think, is there room for someone to be a high-impact researcher in judgment decision-making that isn't trying to do policy-relevant, external sorts of things?
Yeah. You know, what you're saying is actually interesting, because I don't think that looking for impact was ever a major consideration. I mean, it certainly was not. Amos had a broader strategic view of, you know, where we fitted and where our research fitted. But it was really not, it was the fun of discovery. It was really completely bottom up. It was not a plan of what are we going to do. Even sort of what, you know, Stanovich has called the great rationality debate, in which our work, you know, was quite prominent. We didn't use the word rationality for a long time. We did not view ourselves as attacking the rational agent model. This was all a construction that came later, mainly from the readers and not from us. So I think that trying to think about impact is really not the way to go for research. And I'm not sure that it's the way to define what you're looking for when you're hiring someone. I would say hire someone who's doing interesting research. You know, let impact. Well, let that come later, if at all. But some people are really interesting, and others are not so interesting. And looking for the interesting ones, that's really the spot.
If it's okay, I'd like to follow up on that. One of the things that, I'll treat this as a purely self-serving question, but probably there's other people in a similar situation. And in my department, we're go into the process of faculty recruiting. And I would say, if you ask people in the room, like, who should we get? They will give a generic and I consider borderline useless answer. They'd say, well, you know what we should do is we should really get a good person, or the best person. and then you'd say, well, what does that mean? And of course, people can cite, they would start citing, well, this person publishes a lot, or they publish only in the best places, or they publish really good papers, but, you know, this, or they give a great talk, or they're a good thinker, and so on. I would love it if you would offer some insight into what you think is best, in part because that will then become the canonical view and we all agree on that.
You know, obviously it's all of the above. I mean, it's not, what I was saying earlier is, I think, where I would end up. You want somebody who is going to participate in the conversation. I mean, there is, what we're doing academically, certainly in our field, and I think it's true in other fields as well, including the hard sciences, it's a conversation. We're saying things to each other. We're bouncing ideas off each other. Now, you want someone who is going to be a participant in that conversation. And the kind of impact that we're talking about, the high impact, is there are people who get heard, who has something interesting to say that other people want to pause for an instant. You know, mostly we follow our own thoughts, but occasionally you listen to what somebody else is saying. And so you want that. And it's easier, I think, to decide who doesn't have it than who does have it. That is, it's easier to say, well, this person may be competent, but, you know, they're very interesting. You know, it's not somebody that I would like to spend a lot of time with. That I think, is an important feature.
I like that, and I will note that though I like my colleagues a lot, I don't want to spend a lot of time with any of them. I don't think. Across these different concerns, just sort of thinking about like being interesting and being thoughtful, one of the other sort of macroscopic changes that's occurred over the decades in judgment decision making has been its migration from sort of exclusively psychology departments and cognitive psychology in particular to predominantly, or at least more and more, in business schools. And here I'm curious, again, do you think that's good, okay? How do you think it's changed how people study judgment decision making, or how has it changed business schools, I suppose, to the other side?
Well, you know, I certainly encourage my students to go to business because they pay a premium. They pay a premium. The same, you get paid more to do economics in a business school than to do economics in an economics department. So that, and probably it's because historically business schools had low intellectual prestige, so they had to pay a premium. And at the same time, you've got tremendous intellectual talent off into business school. And I think it's been very good for the field as well. That is, that contact with the real world and research in the real world, and field research, and just thinking, even, I mean, I hated to hear my colleagues, I never published in the Journal of Consumer Research, I think I submitted once and it was turned down. Very good paper, I thought. But I really, you know, it was terrible, I thought, you know, the constraints that were put on relevance. And at the same time, I think it's a very good exercise for people to ask themselves, you know, okay, I have that finding. What can I do with it? Where can I see something? So I think it's altogether been a blessing for everybody. You get paid more than you would otherwise. And the field, I think, has gained a lot.
That's great. And also, I like the idea that the prestige of business schools used to be lower than it is now, which is surprising given that every time I talk to psychologists, they're pretty sure that we can't even dress ourselves. a side piece, and you sort of, this came up in part of what you mentioned about trying to take the work and apply it. I know that in recent years, you've been involved in consulting with large organizations and that sort of thing, and I would say that domain more than any other is where here, there's just a lot of us are ignorant, and if you're up for it, I'd be inclined to have some narrative of what you do, what you're interested in, how it works, that sort of thing.
Well, you know, I mean, I've been doing consulting for the last 4 years since I finished the book. I'm focused on that. And I haven't had, my experience is limited. But I do have some impressions. One is that it's, how to say that, I'm likely to be quoted. There is a lot to be proved. Oh, I'm sorry. This is,
hey, you can take
this as a reminder. This is, I'm terribly sorry. I don't want to snooze it, so I'll have to turn it, acrylic. Come on.
Danny, this is my favorite moment of the whole interview.
Relax. I can take it. It's not the first time it's happened. But where I was.
Consulting.
There is a lot of room for improvement. I mean, it is actually remarkable when you have large organizations which depend on high quality decisions. They do not stop to design the decision process. Decision processes in those organizations have evolved. They have a history. And they are what they are because of the way that they evolved, and they evolved in a series of reactions to side effects of previous decisions. Looking at it from a design point of view, there's just an awful lot that can be done if you can get the ear of, you know, the people are in charge of it, which is not easy. So that's one impression. Then, I mean, I have found my work, those organizations, really remarkably interesting. And I'll give an example, though you haven't asked me about it, but something I like to talk about. We know from a lot of work that there is a lot of noise. That's the main reason, actually, that actuarial prediction is better than clinical prediction. That the formula returns the same result when you give it the same data twice. People don't. And in addition, you have employees in an organization who are supposed to be interchangeable. Turns out that they are not. And the variability in the performance of employees doing the same job, if you give them the same task, and I'll just give you an example, I can't identify even the industry. Terrible thing to happen to me. But you have employees who are supposed to be interchangeable, and they are making decisions in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. And you give them a work problem, and you, to a large number of them, and you ask, how much do two randomly chosen employees differ in their estimate of that number? And the executives think it's 5 to 10%, and it turned out to be 40 to 50%. And they have no idea that there is that much noise in the decision-making of that organization. So, you know, that's one example out of quite a few that we've collected. It's the most interesting to me, because that's a direct application of something we know from the laboratory. It's been done, Peter Aitken is here, it's been done on judges in the real world too.
So one part that would come out of that, so here you have this narrative, so we know about that, this obvious inefficiency in this organization, you identify it. Do they listen when you point it out? Do they change things?
Well, you know, I think every consultant should have a Nobel Prize and be 80 years old. Because it lends some credibility to what you say. So I have more credibility than I deserve. And so they sometimes reluctantly listen. But it's really hard to get, especially on important matters. And when you come with a suggestion that really could change things, the difficulty in making things happen in large organizations is extraordinary. You can convince the CEO that you want something done. The CEO actually cannot, changes do not filter because the CEO wants them. So yeah, it's very hard to get through, and I've been luckier than, you know, just because
well, we should all win Nobel Prizes just to be more effective. I want to ask a few questions about it. So in preparing for this, because I, again, don't know anything about interviews, I asked a number of people, like, what should I ask, that sort of thing. And so probably in part because of what I spend my time on, almost everyone wanted me to ask you questions about some form of the state of the scientific value of the field. And I'm, here I'm not looking to pin you down, but more get your insights. And so the one easy version, I can ask you, and maybe it's not easy, but it's the notion of saying, do you feel as though your faith in the field or its findings has wavered at all? Or do you feel like it's changed or updated, or you have it in some way in the years?
I was afraid it was going to come up. There is, as many of you know, there is a crisis of replicability in psychology, and it's been coming on for a number of years. It was apparent that some findings were going to be challenged. That was apparent 4 or 5 years ago. And findings have been challenged. The whole area of unconscious priming is really being questioned. Most of the sort of surprising findings that are published in Psychological Science are now in question. The latest study of replication with 25% of results, this is unbelievable, 50% in cognitive, 25% in social. That's a crisis. And you can predict that people are going to avert their eyes as much as they can because, you know, it's very, very hard to cope with the crisis. But I do think that's a crisis. So a few years ago, I got involved in that debate because I thought that the replicators were at fault. I thought that social experiments demand a special kind of skill that other people don't necessarily have. I knew I didn't have it. So I knew about many of these studies that I couldn't replicate. But I was sure that they were replicable by their authors or by people in that field. There is a crisis. It's a problem. And yes, I would say, because that's important to the book I wrote, you know, so the whole topic of priming looms quite large in my mind. So what do I feel now after all these premises? And I believe, you know, I believe in the reality of priming effects, but I'm convinced now that the effects are much smaller than, you know, than they used to be. Certainly that the set of published results give the wrong idea about the size of the effects, if not worse than that. Individual demonstrations, so I believe in the phenomena. I wouldn't say that my view of psychology has changed profoundly because of this issue, but certainly my faith in individual results has eroded. And I now look at myself and I think I was vulnerable. I think, you know, I can tell you an embarrassing story on this. I once gave a talk about priming to a bunch of entrepreneurs from Silicon Valley, including some very well-known names. And one of them challenged me after I presented sort of dramatic results of priming this. And he said, I don't believe it. And I shot back immediately and I said, belief is not optional. It's been published, you better believe it. And now belief has become optional for a lot of results in the literature. And that's a dramatic event. And we should, it had better be taken seriously.
I'd say one of the criticisms of psychology since forever and judgment decision making since forever would be that unlike many other scientific disciplines, we sort of struggle with being a cumulative science, right? And I would have said that that's in part because we're driven by finding disparate phenomena. It's a young field, and that seems fine. But if it becomes even harder for it to become cumulative if you if you have a lack of belief in the facts that have been reported?
Well, you know, the other side of what I just said, of what I consider to be bad news, is that this is going to change for the better very quickly. I mean, standards are being tightened, you know, right now. This is already happening. Journals are tightening standards. Samples are going to be bigger. This is a major scandal of psychology. The sample size for between subject experiment has been dramatically too small. Jacob Coit pointed that out 50 years ago, and a few years ago, Gigerenzer replicated the work. Nothing had changed. It's the same sample sizes. And when sample sizes are small, you're going to get p-hack. And that's inevitable. And so the reform in insisting on high power research, and the other reform that are taking place, I think that 5 years from now, the field is going to change. But, you know, there are obstacles to that. And the obstacles are, for example, what are the norms for giving tenure? Because if the sample sizes are going to get much larger, people are going to be able to publish less. And there is going to be that tension there going to be. So this is, I'm convinced that this is going to work itself out. I think the profession is responding, but there is something that we should be responding to.
It's good. I like hearing your optimism. I sometimes get a little bit pessimistic on these things, but it is true. Sample sizes are getting larger, there's more attention to it. Do you think that is there something that, to the standard, you say tenure is unreasonable to expect as many publications and so on, is there some way to institute institutional change that sort of makes whatever developments or improvements make them lasting in some way?
Well, I think, you know, the gatekeepers in all this are the journal editors. And the journal editors ought to be thinking about, and they are thinking about how they can improve the replicability and the robustness of results. It is really their responsibility to see to it that stuff that gets published can be believed. And to the extent that we're in a crisis on this, it's a verbal evidence of the change. And then the profession will have to adapt, standards will have to adapt. This is going to be a gradual process. But an image that I've had is like the requirements for gas mileage for car companies. So you say, you know, in 2020, you're supposed to get, on average, like, you know, 40 miles a gallon. We should be able to do something similar for journals, that on average, you should have that level of power for small effects. And you don't get there immediately, but you get there eventually. And we're all becoming conscious of it. So there is a positive response. Not all responses are positive, by the way. I mean, there's a lot, as you know, because probably people are targeting you because you are in the business of studying PHAC. Not everybody loves you.
But, actually, Danny, everybody does love
you. I'm glad to hear that. It also makes a point, but... I love it.
That's what matters. So along those lines, actually interesting, I wanted to ask about, because it does strike me that if you ask academics what scientific dialogue is supposed to be like, there is supposed to be skepticism and argument, and that's healthy, but in many of the exchanges, once they become even slightly public, they sound angry and defensive. Is there something, and I don't know that there's an easy recommendation, but is there something that you would suggest that would sort of make the whole field feel like, oh, no, this is part of scientific dialogue and it's not about being angry, or is that an inevitability?
Well, yeah, I think it's pretty inevitable. I mean, you know, I had a case, you know, in which an article is rejected and you really say, really did a good job of that. It happens, but it's not, you know, the norm is you get irritated. And people are very identified with their results and with their claims and with their ideas. and it becomes part of their ego, and so a lot happens. In the particular crisis that we have now, it's also the case that it's between fields. So there is a field that feels itself threatened. And then you get defensive reactions, and you get people supporting each other within. And so I don't have any recipes for how to solve this. I'm convinced it's going to get solved within the next decade. And it's not, you know, it's going to take a while, but it's going to happen. Everybody is honest about this. You know, it's not that some people are dishonest. Everybody is honest. And everybody would like to do good science. When you get your integrity questioned, which is almost implied when a result of yours isn't replicated, there is a question about your integrity. It arises in society. It makes it very difficult for people to cope with failures. I'm optimistic.
That's great. Along the lines of sort of like a corrective mechanism or something that worked, I think back to, in years past, you've been a vocal advocate for adversarial collaboration, and I would say on paper that I also think it's totally like just an amazing idea, and I would have said without any criticism intended, it really hasn't taken off.
No.
Why not?
Well, it's one of the ideas on the broader stuff, and it really is not a very good idea. It turns out that I've tried two kinds of adversarial collaboration myself. One is the research kind, where you join with somebody and you do joint research, and I've tried it three times, and in the characteristic that all three efforts share is that we found nothing interesting. It just was not productive in terms of yielding good research. My best experience on adversarial collaboration has been in writing. And here, I tried something with George Lowenstein and Dan Ariely when we were having some difficulties. And they were questioning some of my work, and I didn't like their questioning, and so on. And you get into that mode of the critique and the reply and the rejoinder, which is a total waste of time. It is, you're trying to sound sarcastic, and you're trying to be, it's awful. What we ended up doing was write a joint paper. Not a terribly good joint paper, but it was a joint paper where we began by specifying what we agree on, and then we moved on to what we disagree on in two different voices. It's not a standard form of journal article. It should be standard to replace the critique, reply, rejoinder method. I think editors should really put their foot down about those exchanges, because I have never seen one in which anybody conceded it. And it's a disgrace, in a way, to the scientific model that in those exchanges, nobody ever concedes.
Oh, I super endorse that. And journal editors, I agree. That would be an amazing thing if the idea of a co-authored adversarial piece.
Editors could enforce it. And if somebody refused to collaborate, they would be publicly shamed, but their refusal to cooperate would be public. There is a lot that editors can do, and I think a lot that they should do to improve.
I'm going to ask just a couple of more questions before I want to sort of give people in the audience a chance to at least ask a couple of things. One will be sort of an optimistic one, but I'll start with this slightly darker one. So you say, in talking about these issues, you say no one's trying to be a cheat. And I would say that I'm comfortable with saying that's mostly true. But the other remarkable thing from the last number of years has been some exposure of folks that were straight up cheats, right? Dietrich Stoppel and Larry Sanna and so on. And here I'm going to express just a whisper of my own feeling in this, in that I think I started with a belief that, like, oh wow, there's like one bad person, and I think I've shifted towards, you know, that actually happens with some frequency there, and that I don't know how to fix. I'm not sure that the field fixes that. Same way, your narrative in the next 10 years, replicability issues will get worked out. I don't know if fraud does.
I like the concept that you introduced, p-hacking. I think, you know, that's, and I think, you know, many of us have engaged in it. I have found myself, you know, looking back at results, and if I had, you know, I did things that I thought were completely innocent, and I created results that actually were there, and that I ended up believing. So p-hacking is very important. I think self-deception is more prevalent by far than attempts to deceive others. And making, and here there's going to be, something is going to happen, again, because of the structure of the way research is done. Graduate students, you know, research in psychology is done in laboratories, typically with several graduate students, a lot of that happens. They are going to visit the laboratories. I mean, it's a group enterprise, and when standards are known and made public, and if there is a standard, for example, that at a given time you decide, well, data collection starts now today, you know, what are the points that you make behind it? If that is declared and there is a practice in a lab to do that, cheating becomes much more difficult, and it's going to happen once. So I think you want to make self-deception harder, and your work has been quite important in that. And I think the standards and editorial work and so on, this is changing. Bad apples, that, again, there was, I think, you know, Staple. He was trying to get results that were interesting, but not, you know, so interesting, I think, that people would want to replicate or to build on the work. So there was a whole genre of that kind of research. I think that genre may probably be hurt by what has happened. So in fact, the kind of research that Staple pretended to have done, there's going to be less of it. And so the problem will diminish by itself.
I like the optimism in that as well. The last question I'll ask. So in an earlier exchange, I said, oh, I want to ask you some questions about the past and the present and your thoughts on the future, and you made clear that you did not want to be a prognosticator, and I think that's fair. But I will ask some mixture of those, and I'm curious, if you think back to where you were, say, 20 years ago or 30 years ago, and looking at this field, and you said, here's where I think judgment decision-making is going, and you look at it now, I'm curious about, did it do everything you thought it would do? Is it accomplished more than you thought?
It really is not the kind of thinking I engage in. I have never pretended. I've never been terribly interested, actually, in trying to predict the future. And the present is really quite interesting, and there is a lot that you can do. And the short-term future is kind of interesting, and the long-term future, who knows? So I never engage in that, and I'm not, you know, there are certain things that are obvious, and because they're in the present, so that you know that if a lot of very bright people are moving into neuroscience or into neuroeconomics, because they're very bright and self-selected, then for the next 20 or 30 years, there's going to be a lot of good activity in that field. You know, that's trivial. This is just taking the present and extrapolating. And there are, people know what is going on in the present and how it's changing. Beyond that, you know, what is going to be interesting, or, you know, I wish I knew. I wish I knew what's the next thing that's going to make, you know, prospect theory obsolete. I really would, but, you know, I'm not going to see it.
Reasonable. So with that, if it's okay, we have like 6 minutes, and I wanted to at least give a chance to the most ambitious person to ask a question.
I hope you have planted the questions, because otherwise
it's not possible. But you don't think anybody's interested?
You mentioned that you are the more intuitive person in the partnership with Amos. Sometimes I explain to people that Amos was slow thinking and you were fast. Are you comfortable with that kind of identification?
He was a very fast, slow thinker. he was actually known for speed. So, but the kind of thinking that he was bringing in, he knew what he was saying much better than I did. And, you know, that's an experience that is really quite common in scientific work. You say things, and years later, you understood what you said. So it's been said quite explicitly in an earlier paper. And you work it out much, much later. The beauty in our collaboration was that we cut that short. That's the large part of why we were so productive, in that we understood each other. And if there was something in an idea, it didn't have to germinate for years. It was picked up almost immediately. So it was how we divided the work. He was certainly the more critical and the more precise one. That makes me the compliment.
Nathan?
Hi. Thank you for all your contributions.
I wonder if you have something you want to share with all the graduate students in the room as a piece of advice that you know, in some aspirational level feel they would embrace and, you know, help to move the field in a certain direction. Is something you'd want to say to starting out or continuing graduate students today?
Oh, my God. I want to say, I'm old, but I'm not that old, but yes, I am that old. The only advice I think I had for graduate students that I thought was good advice was not to be too stubborn when an idea is really turning out not to be very good. Just not to stick with it too much. There are many ideas, and move to the more interesting thing that you could be doing at this time. So there is a balance to be struck between, you know, being persistent enough when in the face of small failures, and being persistent in the face of, you know, writing a dissertation on a result that you have to apologize for. You shouldn't be getting that. That's what I would tell graduates.
I think that's a good place to stop. It's really been a pleasure, Daniel. Let's all thank him.